Hey everybody, Jay Young here. The Jay Young Show. It's going to be called the John Malden Show because I think we're going to kind of flip the mic a little bit. We don't have the logo to John Malden Show, but John Malden is one of the most unbelievable economists. If you don't have his newsletter, we'll talk about it. Frontline. Go on. Just Google John Malden. Go on the Frontline. Make sure you subscribe to his newsletter if you haven't already done so. I mean, there's just so much information every week, and it's free. So it will fit in your budget right now. You can become one of his closest buddies by just clicking on that subscribe button right there. But he has so many different subscribers that listen, and I've done some of his shows, your conventions. And, yeah. I mean, there's a lot of people that they love John Malden, man. I'll tell you what, he's got a crowd.
You're very, very kind, and I told Jay today that what we're going to do. I'm going to hijack this show. And because Jay's always interviewing people, but nobody ever interviews Jay. And we go back long enough that I think I can interview you.
Yeah.
Let's take you back about 40, 45 years. You're a kid. You're sitting around the table. What's the family talking about?
Well, I guess. Well, is there anything else to talk about?
Yeah.
Isn't that what everybody talks about?
Yeah.
At the dinner table is well, I guess.
Well, but how did that happen?
Yeah. Well, my great-grandfather... And thanks for asking that. But my great-grandfather was in the oil business, and he was a lifer. I mean, like, doesn't matter what's going on, up, down, whatever, he was always in the oil business, and my grandfather was the same way. So if I went over to PUD, this is the name, PUD, P-U-D, went over to granddad's house, then it was all about oil and gas. Matter of fact, he didn't go to school very long, and I would go out. He was a pumper, so we'd go out every day and measure the tanks. And so we'd measure the tanks with a roll to see how much oil it made from the previous day. So let's say if it's 4 feet yesterday and it's 5 feet today, it made a foot of oil. Each inch was 1.67 barrels of oil. Well, I was the one that was doing this math for him. I'd write them down, and he'd write some of them down, but I'd write them all down at the end of the month, end of the week, and I'd do the math for him. And we'd send them into the company every week because that's what you did back then. I mean, today a pumper goes out to a well, he measures it, it's, you know, satellite, right to our office immediately. But back then, it was a lot different. You had to call and pick up all the tickets and do all the things necessary, do the math, and then send them in. So I spent a lot of time with my grandfather, you know, back there, you know, measuring tanks, wondering how do you increase production, you know, just he'd drill some wells. Back then, I never knew him to drill wells. He just took care of the wells after they were already over.
Right. So now, let's fast forward a little bit. You're through college. You're starting to develop a business, and you launched your King Operating, the oil promotion company. So how did that look? What were the early days like?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I'd go out and we'd go through these different companies out here because there's always geologists, you know, these geologists that they may be in a firm or they may be at their house in Midland, you know, where they've got all the information from all the wells around it in their little shed out back or something. And they would go through and map out all the different prospects. And so I'd go through West Texas and we'd look for prospects out there and try to find out what's the best prospect. And then we'd find out how much land they had. And then we would put that prospect, buy that prospect from that geologist. They wanted like, you know, $20,000 over what they had in it, and they wanted 2% override. You know, so if the well did produce in commercial quantities, then they got a 2% override.
More of a landman type thing.
Yeah. So, but they did all the geology, everything necessary to find the prospects, and so then
this was pre-seismic days, right?
No, we had seismic back then, but we didn't have a lot of seismic. I mean, a lot of that was expensive stuff, right? So we did have some prospects did have seismic, some didn't. Some had 2D lines, some had 3D lines. But most prospects back then, I would say, didn't have it. You know, it was more about closeology. We did geology off of closeology. Hey, this well's close to this one, and this one produced this, and it's close to this one over here, and that's what happened. We'd buy that prospect, and then we'd come back to the office, and then my operations team would, you know, bid it out. You know, how many rigs are available? When's the rig available? How much is it? And then also the tubulars or the tank battery, all the different things that goes along with drilling, completing a well. They would find that, and they'd go drill a well. And then I'd find some partners. I'd find some partners on a one-well deal or something that we'd go out and talk to some of our clients and get the money together to go drill that well.
And lots of questions. So this is kind of a random question. You obviously grew up when you were actually going out and measuring with string the amount of oil is in there. Give me the three biggest technology changes you've seen in the last 20 or 30 years in the oil business that have impacted you.
That's a good question. I'm telling this. God, there's so many different things. And you were in one of our operations meeting yesterday.
Yeah, I was. I should say, I've said in some of the operations meeting, and the oil business is really hard. I mean, the nuts and bolts, you drill a hole in the ground, then you go out, a mile or two. That sounds simple, but drilling through all that rock, that's hard rock, and getting that pipe to change and having the technology is really an amazing thing. And it takes, I think it was something a little over 100 different contractors, on one well. I mean, so you've got all these subs, and it's a very fine dance because one has to come in, then after the other, it's like building apartments. You had the people that did the foundations, you'd have the people, the framers, then you'd have the people throw the gyprock up, and then you have, right. You have all these contractors, the right. plumbers, electricians, they all come in.
Right, exactly.
And do their part and then leave.
It's so complex. I mean, there's so many different things. I mean, the one that I like the best or the biggest technology, I know I'm forgetting 400 different things, but the biggest thing that I like is every day I can look on my phone. Well, okay, if we're going to say that much. But every day I can look on my phone and I can see exactly where the drill bit is, how deep they are, if they're going horizontal, if they're not going horizontal, where the drill bit is. I can see that. How fast are they drilling? How much weight's on the bit? Are they crooked? Are they going different dip or whatever? I can see that on my phone. The other thing that I like a lot is I can look on my phone every morning and the production. I can see exactly what the production is from yesterday's talent. So the pumper goes by there all day today, let's say, and then if some of them don't have Wi-Fi, which some of them don't have Wi-Fi where they are, then when they get home or when they get into a satellite and next to their small town, all the information they put in their cell phone will download, and then it will be downloaded. Then the next morning at 7 a.m., here's on my phone, I can see exactly what each well does. Because you want to know what each well did yesterday, but also, is that good or bad, right? If it just says 78 barrels, you go, okay. But what if it says 78 barrels minus 5%? Whoa, wait a minute. That's too big of a variance. So then you can do something about it right then. Then I call our people in the operations and go, hey, did you see number 34 well? It's down 5% today. That's when that's some great technology that you can stop before something really bad happens or make sure that you get your on top of it. That's a big technology. But I mean, the fracs, okay, we were talking about horizontal drilling in Midland, right? So this isn't necessarily an app or a computer, but we were drilling wells in Midland back 2000, 2005, and we were just drilling vertical wells because the vertical stack of wells out there was enormous. There's all these different vertical stacks.
But any stacks, you mean zones yeah. that have hydrocarbons in them.
Right. You may have the Sprayberry. You may have the Wolfcamp A, B, C, D. You may have old Strawn, Ellenberger. I mean, there's all these different, But we weren't really making any money unless oil prices were high on drilling these things vertical. So we would do it and try it and do the best we could. And all of a sudden, it's just like, didn't make money. But, if prices are $80, good. But if prices aren't, you're not making any money. So what they decided to do finally after the Bakken, Marcellus had drilled horizontal wells, they started drilling wells in Midland. All the way out in Midland, they drilled horizontal wells, but they could frack them hard enough to produce this whole interval because our geologist, Joe Seymour, back then in 2005 and 6, looked at the wells that we had drilled. We drilled 10 straight wells, 10 straight vertical wells, and then we fracked them all. They came in 100 barrels a day. They'd level off at 10 or 15 barrels a day forever. But then Joe Sima, our president at the time, said, we need to drill these wells horizontally. But the zones were so thin, that didn't make sense. You know, it wasn't like a 200-foot zone or 300-foot zone. So it didn't really make sense to drill horizontally until somebody did, right? Until somebody did and found the Permian Basin to be one of the most prolific oil and gas fields in the world. It was producing 1 million barrels a day back then, up in 2010. Today, it's 5.5 million barrels of oil per day.
So almost half of what the entire U.S. does from that one field. Not even the East Texas fields or the Barnett Shale or anything. There's that one field. And not even the New Mexico fields that are right next to it.
Right.
I mean, it's...
Well, the Delaware Basin, which is in New Mexico, that is part of the Permian Basin.
Okay.
It's just right. It's all connected. So that is true. But you're right. Eagle Ford, Bakken, Marcellus, all the other oil fields all across. This Permian Basin is unbelievable. I mean, there is, you know, billionaires are made every day at things like out there because of all the oil that's being produced. But they're expensive wells. I mean, they're $15, $20 million to drill these long laterals. Plus, you have to have the acreage. You know, so the people that got in real early and had a lot of this production, you know, a lot of vertical wells held a lot of production, especially for the Sheffield family, the Pioneer Natural Resources. You know, Scott Sheffield, his son Brian, and their granddad owned so many different wells out here that were held by these vertical wells, just like where you grew up.
Okay.
In Bridgeport, George Mitchell owned all these vertical wells out there. Then he invented fracking, and then all of a sudden the acreage became worth, it was $200-$300. Now it's $20,000-$30,000
right
an acre, and it's just amazing.
Well, I mean, it's
the prices
we talked about. I actually grew up in the oil patch. It was old man Christie funded these two young A&M engineers, the Mitchell brothers.
Right, right.
And it was all vertical wells. It was a dirty, nasty business. I mean, and it was boom-bust cycle.
Yeah.
We'll come back to that in a minute because I learned about busts when you'd see your friends' fathers at home.
Mm.
Because it seemed like everybody was either working in the gravel truck business like my dad or they were in the oil business. You know, it's just Bridgeport's a working-class city.
Right.
And I remember, you know, that was kind of my image. It was almost like the big picture type of image of oil and gas. And then here, like 7 years ago, a banker that was funding a lot of what was going on the Bakken took me up, the land guy, for 20% of the wells. He had a piece of 20% of the wells in the Bakken.
Wow.
We went in his helicopter, and then later he and I just did a tour of the next year in his plane. He'd say, well, our well's starting right here. And you'd look down, it'd be a wheat field. He tapped my shoulder. He says, see that pad 2 miles out there? He says, yeah, this is where it starts. And you fly 2 miles. And he says, we're drilling, you know, up to 16 wells from that one pad.
Mm-hmm.
And they were starting just then to have wells that would walk themselves. Mm-hmm. Because in the Bakken, you could go down four levels. I mean, there were four zones, mm-hmm. and you could go north, south, east, and west. So they just move it over, and it was amazing. But what I think the most amazing part to me was how clean it was, because I grew up, I grew up in Wise County when it was dirty and hot anyway, and the Bakken was just so clean. I mean, when you got into the cities, there would be lots of trucks, and so you'd have that, but. But out in the country where they were drilling, it was pretty clean.
Yeah.
At night, you'd fly over it, and the sky would just be lit up with all the flares.
Oh yeah,
because you know
you didn't need lights.
It was kind of my, you know, background on oil and gas. And then you and I met. You were at a party that before you became an owner of the Texas, a part owner of the Texas Rangers, I had an office in the baseball park.
Right. Right.
And
you're a big baseball fan.
I've been known to attend a few baseball games, yes. And
how's it right now not being able to watch the Rangers living in Puerto Rico? You got to find some satellite or something.
Well, I mean, you could see them, you know, I'm still trying to get used to these new uniforms. I'm going, where did that uniform come from?
Yeah, he landed Sunday, and he texts me, the uniforms? I said, hey, they're winning. Hey,
as long as
their averages are up and they're winning, so you never whatever it takes.
Yeah, if you got to wear the socks inside out, you're all part. Is that
exactly.
What it is? So for 20 years, I mean, we just became friends, and you'd call me up for 20 years
mm-hmm.
and say, John, I got this deal we're doing. And I'd look at it and I'd say, well, thank you, Jay, but just not interested. Because just to me, oil and gas royalties weren't a big driver for me. I mean, it's a nice business.
Mm-hmm.
I love to have royalties. I'm a big believer in royalties, but and I could have used the tax write-off, but that wasn't enough to push me over the edge. Apart, even when I was bullish, apart from the, I mean, I'd be bullish on oil.
1-3-1 or
yeah, but
type returns. And
but
I didn't make it sexy enough for you.
Well, it wasn't a matter of sexy. It was just a bond type, you know, coupon thing. And there were, I thought, different opportunities. But I became very bullish on oil here about 3 years ago as I looked more and more at what the ESG movement was doing to the oil and gas business. It's reducing the amount of money going in. It's making it, you know, it's non-woke.
Mm.
I mean, just the economist in me sits up and says, the investor sits up and says, wait a minute, you're making it more difficult to get something that the demand is only increasing every year and it's going to increase every year for the next 20 years. And all you're going to do is drive the price up. Well, then I began to look to see how do we play that? I mean, you could invest in companies or some private things, but the royalty thing never really spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
And the sidebar here is that I never really wanted to put my clients in the oil and gas business because of the boom bust nature of it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think this is not to say that a recession couldn't create another downturn in the oil market. Recessions typically do, but I think long-term demand's going to increase production. Right now, the U.S. is a swing producer. We're not producing that much. We have to find 5 million barrels a day of oil in the world just to maintain the production of last year, because it's just normal depletion. I mean,
yeah.
You've got your own wells. The wells that you hit 10 years ago, 15 years ago, are not producing anywhere close to what they were the first year.
Then we haven't been fine.
They're still producing, maybe, but that production, it depletes. And, I mean, I remember in the 70s, the big thing was Hubbard's Peak, and we were going to run out of oil. And I always said, that's silly. I mean, there's the whole Malthusian, we're going to run out of everything, is silly. But I just didn't... I'm not somebody that wants to hold a client's hand through booms and busts,
mm-hmm.
okay? Because typically clients want to put money in when something's hot and moving as opposed to when it's down. It's the opposite of the Warren Buffett style. But as I was trying to figure out, I called you and other people up and says, what are you doing? You know, what are you doing? And you started to tell me how you're doing something different. And it started with a ski trip. You're in Colorado. You're going up the slopes with a very famous, we won't drop his name, real estate investor that does apartments. And what did you learn?
Yeah, good question. So first thing is, hey, you know what? I made some mistakes in the oil and gas business because you had to structure the deals, right? So I sit back in 2015, and I've already asked John for 20 years to participate. This time I asked you, and you should have done it, but anyway. but yes, you're right. I mean, I did go up this chairlift, and I just sat there and thinking, talking to my wife, going, I don't know what I'm going to do. Oil prices are down right now, and I know this is buy low, sell high. I mean, if anybody should know this, it's Mr. Alden, right? Buy low, sell high. But I didn't know, and I was like, you know, I don't like doing deals the way that I've been taught and the way that deals are being sold on a retail market. I can't do it anymore. I know they're terrible. I know they don't make money. It's like, man, what else can I do differently? So I was on this chairlift with this guy, and I asked him, I said, hey, I'll say this first, David, how's business? Now, if you buy my book, you'll see the name in there, or I'll send you my book if you write me a note. Mm-hmm. But I said, David, how's business? And he goes, man, he goes, truthfully, Jay, he said, I can't get enough. I mean, he said, I'm just so busy right now. We're trying to find apartments like no tomorrow. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, I got clients lined up outside just waiting to look at our project. And I said, man, that's the opposite of what I have. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, this is, but and asking the million-dollar question that's been super for our investors and for my family is asking the question, how do you structure your deals? Now, John, I don't know where I got that question from. Before I do a podcast or anything, we had the Jay Young and John Malden show. Before any of that, I'd ask him, how do you structure your deals? And I'll never forget, he told me, and he sat down with me after we you know, ate afterwards, and I was talking to him, and I kept asking him questions. I'd call him back 2 or 3 weeks later and go, now tell me that again, you know, because, but what we do is do the value add more, you know, where he would find the apartment complex, Dallas-Fort Worth, that's where he started, and he'd find it, and it was rented, but it was like 20-30% vacant. People just didn't really care about it anymore. They may have walked away, or family, or, you know, whatever the case may be, old property. But he said, you know, we'd buy that. We would, and he's an MBA, and his partner was, and they would look at it, they would do the numbers and say, okay, we can buy it for this, we can put this much money into it, and we can sell it for this. And if we don't want to sell it, we could cash flow it. And he said, we just started off, and he said, I'll never forget my first deal. I had my credit cards lined up on my kitchen table with my wife, and we were just thinking about how are we going to pay for this deal. We put so much money down, and we don't have. He said, all my credit cards added together, and he said, we finally bought that property, sold it, or got some investors in. But his first 50 deals, he sold 25 of them, and he's cash flowing 25. And now he's one of the biggest apartment single individuals. He's got 40,000 doors right now that he's managing. And he doesn't like to sell, but that just kind of happens with his deal because he
likes. Well, what he was doing, though, and interesting, he would go into a good neighborhood with an older apartment,
mm-hmm.
and renovate the apartments. You'd be able to increase the rents. Now you've got a Class A apartment doing better, and that's now you've improved the property. You can sell it at a significant price increase. And as I've started exploring what you're doing the same thing. You go into it's an older field. Got a bunch of vertical wells into it, nerve wracking.
Right.
20 years old, 25 years old, but it's still producing. We're not exploring. We know the oil's there.
Right, right.
And it's, I thought your analogy of, it's like a stack of pancakes, especially in the Permian, where you've got all these, you put a straw in there and you're only going to get the oil from around that straw if you stop it at the right part of that stack.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you go down horizontal and you go along that stack, then you're getting 2 miles worth of, you know, wells.
Right.
So you're getting it's like a dozen or half dozen or whatever wells along that lateral, that horizontal line. And that increases your proven and probable reserves around that thing. And you, let's say you've got 10,000 acres and you drill 10, 15 wells on it at the right locations. Now you've said, look, this field has this much proven reserves. We've proven it with these wells.
Mm-hmm.
And the probable reserves of between here are X.
Mm-hmm.
And proven reserves are worth this. Probable reserves are less worth a fraction of that. But it adds up because now you've demonstrated that it's not the 2, 3, 4 barrels a day that old vertical well was doing. Now you're talking, 100 barrels a day, more, whatever.
Right.
And the value is not in the oil and gas. It's not in the royalty stream, though. We certainly want the royalties while we're waiting, but you're waiting for that field to be valued, and then you sell the whole field, and you let the retail investors participate in the field.
Right.
Now, if you're an institutional investor, you get that deal. That's exactly, you're already getting that. You walk in with your $100 million, so your pension fund and endowment, and you walk to one of the big groups that does that. And you're into the field, but you've got $100 million. That's their minimum to get into their big programs. That's what you're doing. And I should say we, because now I'm a partner in the
field. Yeah, entire GP advisor.
You're giving
the retail
investor an opportunity to get into the field. And that's where the value is. Now, you know, you look at an investor and you have to say, guys, we're going, you know, 1.5 miles, 2 miles down, and we're going 1.5 miles, 2 miles out. It's dark down there. We've got all of the 3D seismic. We've got all the information from every well that's been drilled all the way around it. You've got all the other technology that you've done, but you're still drilling in the dark. So this is not easy, but it's knowable. It's doable, and you can de-risk it. And what you've done in your fund, which I like, is multiple fields. So we've got, you know,
seven,
a couple in East Texas, yes, some Wyoming, some Colorado. You know, so even if one field doesn't produce as much, well, you know, you've got a chance at other fields. Right now, it pays you a lot more to drill for oil than it does gas. So the gas fields that we have are sitting there, you know, with wells that have been drilled, but they haven't been, and they're not in production yet. Because I would rather have, as a partner, and you would too, I'd rather have that oil to be sold at $3.54 in the future than selling it at $2 today.
Yeah, well,
I mean, so just you know, because we will get more LNG terminals offshore. We will ship this stuff out of the price. I think the price of gas will go back up, because you can look at what the price of gas is in Europe and Asia and go, yeah,
they're paying $15-$20 over there.
Yeah.
Russia and Ukraine.
Yeah.
They're getting 40% of their gas out of Russia right now. It's not working very well for them, but it's also, they're paying out the nose. And we're right now it's $2.50, $2.60 or something here. And we can export it for a dollar. I mean, we can still make some money.
You make a lot of money.
A lot of money.
It's just, you just got to build, you got to, these LNG terminals take, you know, what, $8, $5, $10 billion in 5-10 years.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they're, and that's before you get to permitting them.
Right.
And these, this, but at my conferences last year, without any prompting from me, three or four of the attendees were talking about, you know, three-figure oil, 100. Felix Suloff, one of the best commodity traders, investors in the world, demonstrably so, started to talk $150 oil. And frankly, if we don't start drilling more, that's where we're going. The rest of the world, if you look at their production, is kind of flat. They're increasing their drilling enough to kind of maintain where we are. The U.S. is that steel swing producer, but we're not. I mean, our rig count's the lowest it's been in years.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that, by the way, is the rig count, just sidebar, can be a little misleading, because 15 years ago, we had a high rig count, but two-thirds of those rigs were drilling just vertical wells. Today, nearly all of the rigs are producing horizontally. You still have some vertical wells. We're drilling some vertical wells, because there are some places that it just makes economic sense to do a vertical well. But so a horizontal well, an unconventional well, will do replace a dozen, half dozen rigs. And right, you know, so you don't need as many rigs to get the same amount of oil.
Right.
So you can't just look at rig count to make a decision.
Right.
But nonetheless, it's still down. We're just not drilling as much as we could.
Yeah, exactly. We see our production numbers that are coming down. You know, we're not producing as much oil here as we were before.
Right.
We got up to 14.6 million barrels of oil under Trump, and now we're at 12.8, 12.9, you know, under Biden, and it's going down. And if there is a Democrat in as a president next election, you'll just see that price. You'll see it continue to go down. I mean, they just don't, they feel like, the Democrats feel like that we have, you know, that it's bad. We don't want oil and gas, and we want to stay away from it. We're just going to do away with anything we can. We're going to talk bad about it. That's where you get a lot of the money. A lot of the money's not coming back to the table because institutions are saying, well, if Biden thinks that we're going to run out of oil or we don't need oil in 10 years, why do we want to, you know, put money into it? Or
right,
permits. We just got a pass where we got two permits in Wyoming, and we've been waiting for a year to get these permits because it's BLM, Bureau of Land Management, federal government. And it's in Texas, I can go tomorrow. I go tomorrow and, hey, I need to drill a well right here. And they go, all right, well, you got to wait till tomorrow because we've already gone for the day or something.
Yeah.
I get it tomorrow. But in Wyoming or Colorado or Utah, California, those other states, it's a problem. It's a very big problem. So I mean, I think what you were saying a minute ago, and I mean, I want to kind of say this real quick, is that, you know, I came back from the trip, and I had MBA, a Rice MBA,
right,
in my office, along with SMU getting a CFA, and I came back from my trip with this guy I met him on the ski lift, and I said, okay, I got it figured out now. I got it. We're going to do it a different way. And they just kind of looked at me like, okay, so what kind of trip did you go on? And look, because every time you go on a trip, you come back, you have all this new information for your staff, and they don't like the day you come back. I'll be able to be out of the office when I come back because I get so many ideas. But I said, hey, you know what we're going to do? We're going to take my experience in the oil and gas business, because my great-grandfather drilled multiple wells. My grandfather, my dad was in the business. I've been around this business. I like to take my expertise in the oil and gas business and put it in a system or a way where, hey, you know what? Clients can make money. You know, I mean, it's not a guarantee, but when you drill wells in a proven area and you increase the value, it's going to be worth more later. Now, oil and gas prices shrink. That's a different story. And oil and gas prices will go up and down. Every year, John, I mean, like this year, I'm doing as much as I can to get production up as much as possible. And I may put this thing up for sale at the end of this year. I don't think I'll get what I want, but I'm going to have everything ready to go, because you never know what oil and gas prices are going to do. Next year, we may do the same thing and just see if we can make a 2X, 3X on our capital from equity. If we can, why not? Because you never know. It reminds me of some of the mistakes that I've made in the oil and gas business that everybody gets to learn from, is I went with a mezzanine person on an asset. We sold a third of the asset, gave clients back 131% of their money. Program one. Incredible. Great returns for them. They're all happy. That's the one I told you should have done. I did talk to you about that one. Right across the street from where you live. We had lunch that day. I didn't really want to talk to you about it, but I said, God, I really like this. Anyway, different story. So we did that, and then we built it up, and I got some financing from a mezz group that wouldn't let me sell when I got it up to $300 million. You know, I had this thing up to $300 million. I said, man, let's sell. I raised some more capital. I raised like $30-40 million from investors, and I'm like, okay, our clients will make a fortune. We need to sell. And they said, we don't want you to sell yet. Keep those two rigs running that you have, and let's do it. Well, the 2018, look at the oil and gas prices. They killed it. I mean, just went way down. Nobody's buying anything. We stopped drilling, you know, all this stuff happened. But at that time, I'm like, I put these assets up for sale every year. Because, I mean, you never know what's going to happen. You want to make sure that, you know, because if oil and gas prices do cycle in and out, you don't know. So, you know, one thing I learned was, hey, raise good equity from partners and treat them right. Make sure that you put it in some type of value-add system to where we're value-adding and selling, or sell half of it, give clients their money back, and cash flow the rest of it. I mean, your wife would love to have $20,000-$30,000 a month coming in.
Right.
Months you go to the mailbox, but we don't do mailboxes anymore, right? But anyway.
I think I've got one somewhere.
But, you know, just doing the right thing for the investors, the most important things to us. And as I get older, I think about it and I go, you know what? I learn a lot. You can't do this just by, you know, taking a couple of classes in college and getting out and all of a sudden you know how to drill complete wells and produce them. And putting the project together like we do right now to make it attractive for an oil and gas company. We just had a guy come on board, Ali Ahmed, who's had three transactions over $1.3 billion. Two of those transactions are over $600 million that he's had at his other companies.
And in the last 10 years.
Oh, yeah. He's killed it. He's a lawyer, a CFO, and he's also an entrepreneur. He's had three companies.
One of the things that I've been impressed with, and in our association, you know, as we become partners, is the quality of people that you attract. And you and I both, we're both strong individuals, but we both know that we're much better off hiring people smarter than we are to help us do the things that we need to get done.
Right. Right. Yeah, and I have hired Ollie, and he has a great team of people underneath it. But he knows that team. I mean, he knows that team that you know, you need a land man, you need somebody to do your filings with all the state. I didn't know that when I first got in the business. And I was giving things, we're going to shut down your wells if you don't, you know, and scare me to death. But geologists, engineers, what kind of engineers do you need? What kind of geologists? Because it's all about geology and following that geology. You know, it's like the old man I was talking about out in the shed, you know, looking at logs and putting together prospects out in Midland. Love him. But that's where you prospects start is an idea.
It's the older gentleman on one of your rigs that you were telling me that I just find fascinating. He can stand there as the mud comes up and he says, that's hydrocarbons.
Mm-hmm.
And some he can smell the hydrocarbons in the mud coming up.
Right.
Just that experience of and the team. I mean, there's a lot of gray hair in the room.
Yeah.
Or no hair. right now, I'm just happy to have hair.
It was like my grandfather. You know, I drive with the old 3-speed on the column for my grandfather in the old fields, and he'd say, all right, Jake, shut down the truck. Pull up this well right here, pumping unit going up and down. He said, okay, now slow down, turn the car off, and he just listened to the pumping unit go all the way up and down. But what he was doing was not only seeing if the pumping unit was oiled, well oiled, but he was also hearing downhole the motor, because you have rods tubing and you have a downhole motor, and he could see if that was also. I mean, there's just amazing, right? That he could just sit there and just think about, you know, all the different things. And my dad said that he remembers him waking up in the middle of the night because a pumping unit would go wrong or something, and it'd wake him up because it was something weird, you know. But yeah, those kind of people are amazing. You know, my grandfather definitely was an incredible guy. You talk about getting messy, man. The back of his El Camino, he had an El Camino because he just threw everything in the back.
Those were cool cars back in the...
Oh, man, yeah. His was really messy, man, I'll tell you what. But that was the oil field. He went to the oil field every day. I mean, 7 days a week. Never missed a day. You know, he took a week vacation sometimes to go to our family reunions, you know. Because my great-grandfather had 12 kids, so... And they all lived and grew up in Big Spring in Cahoma area. And so you have 12. And if you're
for the readers that don't, listeners that don't know, that's deep West Texas.
Yeah.
That's not, I grew up on the edge of West Texas.
Right.
Okay. Your family was deep West Texas.
That's exactly right in the middle.
That's in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, it is. That's where on a Friday night or Saturday night when you have football season, they'd all get together at the stadium, the football stadium, and fight. Because they had nothing else to do, right? They just get together and fight, you know. But 12 kids, you know, and my grandmother was the oldest. But if you're a man, you're in the oil business. And if you're a woman, you're married to somebody in the oil business. And, man, they had kids upon kids. And then, you know, it's just getting together family reunions. And he had four brothers. You remember this in my book. He had four brothers. There was five youngs. That A.B. Young put my grandfather, and then he had four brothers. I mean, it was just like, that was it. I mean, alongside it was a different story. She didn't have anybody in the old business. Like, he was an entrepreneur, but everything's, we're talking about the old business pretty much all the time.
We're just about out of time here.
Yeah.
So let me give you the mic back and let you interview me.
Yeah, there you go. So, John, what did you think about, or what made you change your mind about, you know, I mean, I bought you enough lunches over the years. It wasn't you felt bad for me and you thought,
No.
I think I'll finally.
I have no problem with you buying me lunch anytime.
Still true today, even though we're partners. But what is it that you, well, what did you like about our deal? You're not in the old business, but you also talked to other people.
Well, I talked to the people and I really liked the people. I liked the team. The more I looked at it, the more comfortable I became. But I like the economics. It's all about risk reward. I mean, when I had to close my broker dealer down, which was not a small financial hit to me in terms of annual income. But I just looked at this, and I think the potential is enough for me to walk away from that bird in the bird in the hand, because I think there's a big nest over there. In the bush. Now we know of at least one other company that's, you know, putting their land into the deal, basically doing what you're doing. My belief is in 5 years, the traditional oil and gas promoter will be a small subset of the oil business, because everybody's going to say, no, no, I want to own part of the land like that deal. And I mean, I think you've really pioneered something for retail investors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not doing anything new in the sense of, but it was all institutional. You're giving a smaller retail investor, and we got to put air quotes around smaller retail investor. We're talking somebody worth $2-5 million.
Right.
You've got to be an accredited investor.
Right.
So this, but you know, still, they never had a shot at something like that.
Right.
And
that's because my background with Ken Hirsch, Billy Quinn, right. Ray Davis, all those guys with the Texas Rangers. You know, I sit a lot of Texas Ranger guys with my co-owners at the Rangers, and Ken Hirsch, you know, who's an incredible guy, NGP, and a partner with Richard Rainwater, and made a ton of money on his deals that he did. And I would just ask him, because he said, I got 54 companies right now we're backing. What do you mean you're backing? What are you doing? Well, how are you doing it? What, you know, I was just asking all the questions necessary, and just to find out, okay, and then find out about him, and then all of a sudden, a couple of years later, I run into David, and all of a sudden I'm going, how did they hit me with it again? I'm like, man, God's telling me to change the way that I'm structuring our projects, and how do I do that?
And number one, that attracted me. Number two, when you're in the oil business, especially like you are and we've grown up in, it's difficult. I mean, you've got enough experience and the team, and you've drill punched enough holes in the ground that you know the process. And so I was comfortable with that. And I'm just bullish on the oil prospects in general. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, we'll see how the fields that you've chosen, your team and the geologists, and right now everybody's kind of giggling and happy because they found some extra zones in one of our fields, and that's always a good thing.
That's good.
But it is, you've still got to raise some money, you've got to prove it up. And one of the things that you've done with this fund that I like is we're going out and raising a larger sum of money, because I think you can't do a multiple field, multiple well field on a $20 or $30 million or $50 million fund anymore. It just doesn't work.
Right.
The physics, the math doesn't work.
That makes sense for an oil and gas company. We sell to retail public, or not retail, we sell to public companies, right? But there's not, Exxon is not going to come by and look at our deal. We want to sell for $2-3 billion. They don't really care about $2-3 billion. They made $7 billion last quarter, and that was really low from their $17 billion they made the year before. So there's 1,000 companies that make this attractive for a $2-3 billion deal. And you just can't go out. And that's one thing that I realized is I got to raise a lot more money. We've got to come in here and raise a lot more money, because we got to get this, we got to scale this to a certain amount to make it
economical and rational. Because in essence, what we're doing is in a field that if there's 100 potential wells and we drill 10 of them, the new guys come in and say, okay, you've now shown us what's underneath there.
Right.
And we'll drill these other 90, we'll pay you a multiple on it because you've de-risked this for us.
Right.
Because if you're a public company right now, your investors are saying, we want to go in known areas and we don't want you risking. I mean, we want you to some degree, we're their cast ball. We're the guys out in front, proving up an old field. Now, our risk is, you've always got mechanical risk. You've always got, you know, you can find a spot in the ground that doesn't really want to be drilled. You know, no matter how much pressure you put on it, that ground's just hard. But we pretty much know where we're going to find the oil.
Right.
I mean, we're going to find oil. It's just how economical will it be? I mean, can we get enough oil out of the ground at a price? And then what's the price of the oil going to be? Is it going to be $40 or $50? Is it going to be $80, $90, $100? I mean, today it's above $80.
Well, the geology on our first field that we did, which was 2015,
yeah.
You know, I was talking to our geologist, and I said, well, what kind of deal do you have that's a big deal? And he goes, hey, I got this field right here. And he mapped it out, and he said, there's 25 wells in here, 25 vertical wells out here that produced 1 million barrels of oil, 2 billion cubic feet of gas. And he said, it's out of the Strawn Formation. And I'm like, wow, okay. And I said, can you drill horizontally there? And he goes, I believe so. And I said, are you sure? And he goes, yeah. So we spent $1 million putting this acreage together and all that together. And then we drilled our first well out there, and we drilled vertical, went down to the zone. So we know, you know, vertical well, I know you know this, but just for some of your listeners that may not know, you know, a vertical well is drilled all the way down through the formation, and maybe down to the Ellenberger formation. So you know, at a certain depth, you're going to hit the strata. And it may go up and down based on the structure, and you may have a structure where the project comes up. So, but you know the structure's there. I mean, you know the formation's there. Is it economic or not? I mean, who knows, right? How much is it going to cost you to drill it? How much oil is going to come out of the ground? At what price? Those are the three things that you have.
Right.
So we did this, and we came out here. I found some partners, not you, but you can turn me down. But I said, hey, let's go drill this well out here. So we did. We raised $6 million or $6.5 million, something. And we came out here, and all of a sudden, we drilled a well, and we went horizontal and went out. And I'll never forget, I'm out there. We're over budget. We're supposed to be like $4 million or $4.5 million, and we're over budget. And we're fracking it. And I said, Bill Riley, God bless his soul. I said, Bill, I said, what's going on? No, Bob. I'm sorry, Bob Riley. I said, Bob, what's the deal? I said, man, it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. And I said, what's the deal? And he said, well, you only let me get to frag it one time. He said, we're going to hammer this thing to no end. He probably said some choice words in there. So,
yeah.
But he said, you know, we're going to hammer this thing. So about a week later, we frack it, and we're waiting for the wall to come out of the ground, you know, kind of like the clampets.
Yeah.
We're waiting for the oil to come out of the ground, and we just stare at it. I mean, we're sitting there staring at it. Where'd the oil go? Well, it went on vacuum. So it went on vacuum, which means that it went down instead of up. And we're like, well, what is this all? And we're doing the science, right? And we're trying to figure out what, where, how. And we're looking down, and then one of the engineers out of Albany, Neil, he said, don't worry about it. Just keep waiting. It's going to come out of the ground. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Well, then it finally did. It came out, and it started producing 300-400 barrels a day. Went down to 100, 200 barrels a day after 90 days. Great well. We drilled the second well, longer lateral, 5,000-foot lateral. This is like 1,800-foot lateral. And we made some great success. But it was a lot of fun, but not at the time. I mean, not we're over budget, and all of a sudden I'm looking for the oil down the hole. It's just not – I mean, normally when you frack a well and spend as much money as we did fracking a well, it's going to come out of the ground. It's going, you better step back, because it's going to come out. You got to put some bows on here, make sure that it doesn't just spew all over everywhere. That's a different story for the guy that oil spewed all over his cotton patch out in Texas. I'll tell you that story afterwards. I don't have time right now, but I mean, this oil business is really great. And the thing that I would say is, I may not be the guy for some of your listeners or whatever. I understand that, you know, and I've made mistakes, but I'll tell you what, we've aligned ourselves right now with some great people in our office. You've met them, you know them, and a great asset or two. We have two great assets right now. We have two great big assets that we could drill multiple wells and sell it to a big public company. And we structure it right for you and for your investors. So,
right.
I tell you what, I do appreciate you.
Well, I do. And, you know, I've been in Dallas this week, and I'll probably be in Dallas a little bit more over the coming next few years. It's from here to Puerto Rico, it's a 5-hour flight. So I've flown it enough now that the same stewardesses, the stewards, airline attendants know me. Say, John, how are you doing? That's it. So you know,
you got hard to forget.
Well, you know, you've been on a plane too much when you're seeing friends and, you know,
put their napkin down.
Yeah. Well, they don't do that anymore. The world, that's gone.
Not even for John Mullen. No, John has the largest subscription letter.
Well, it's one of the largest
subscription letters. For being an economist, all about supply and demand.
It is.
But
listen, we're going to finish it up. I'm going to finish up the Jay Young Show. Thank you. Let me turn around here. Thank you for your time, your attention. Jay, thank you for your having me out today. And then, let's go find some oil.
Good. That's awesome. Okay. Thanks, John.